I think this issue of extreme nationalism is not unique to the United States. I mean, Russia's definitely in this hyper-nationalist moment. China, right now, I think Xi and the Communist Party is really trying to replace the sort of fading communist dream with a nationalist one. This is certainly the case in the European democracies, movements like the AfD in Germany, or the whole either UKIP or the Brexit debacle had to do with this notion of reasserting the nation vis-a-vis nebulous global forces that people can't control. There are some similarities to this earlier very nationalist moment. So if you go back to the 20s and 30s, of course, nationalism, it's not the sole thing that led to the First World War, but it was a huge part of the very toxic cocktail that had led to that epic disaster. And so, you know, nationalism was very much up for grabs in the post-World War I era in terms of defining what the nation was going to be, in terms of defining its institutions. If you look at a country like France or Britain, you know, their democratic institutions came through that war intact. Other nations either didn't really have them when they entered the war at all, and that would be the case of Russia, or if they had them, like in Germany and Italy, they were very, very weak. I mean, ultimately, I think it's a bit of a caricature to say that pre-World War I Germany was an authoritarian dictatorship. I mean, it certainly had elements of that. It was a monarchy in which the monarch had a lot of power. But there was a very real, lively, participatory culture in the Kaiserreich. That was the preceding regime up in sort of 1871 to 1918 is when it implodes. So Germans were habituated to democratic behavior. I don't think that was the issue. But I think institutions were in total turmoil and upheaval after the war. And this, I think, does kind of echo a little bit this present moment, that there are nebulous dark forces that are controlling the economic or the social or the cultural destiny of the nation. I think that is very much alive and well on both the far left and the far right in very different ways in the U.S. now. You know, in the case of Germany, the argument Hitler made, and he was one of many anti-Semitic sort of pundits in the post-war era, his argument was that the Jews were these, you know, the string pullers that were essentially behind the scenes directing not only the corrupt democracy that was Weimar, but also simultaneously the Soviet Union and the United States. That was sort of the argument that only made sense if you bought into the basic tenets of anti-Semitism. But he was certainly not alone in terms of that sort of conspiracy theory mongering. I think the Bolshevik Revolution really added a very ugly edge to nationalist fears that a racial slash ideological tidal wave was going to wash over Europe. The Nazis, you know, Hitler, Rosenberg, Goebbels really did tend to interpret Bolshevism and far left politics through a racial lens. And again, I don't think anti-Semitism is the dominant script in the right in the United States in the same way that it was in Germany, but there's certainly a racialized notion of, I mean, if you look at the whole discourse about Black Lives Matter on the right, or this discussion of Antifa right now, or this whole idea that George Soros is somehow a string puller that can make a million people show up to ruin your inauguration. But that's not just an American right-wing sort of motif. You see that stuff in Hungary, this argument that George Soros somehow can magically throw money at hundreds of thousands of humans and mobilize them. And, you know, I think they're feeding on both an extreme sense of nationalism now, and that certainly was the case in the 20s and 30s, but also just a sense that conventional liberal with a capital L, so free trade, one man, one vote, open markets, sort of we've muddied the waters of it in America, because when we say liberal, usually we mean progressive or quote unquote pinko. But liberal, this idea that liberalism with a capital L, now we'd probably call it neoliberalism, the neoliberal establishment, cannot deliver the goods. You know, it can't stop jobs shedding away. It can't stop, you know, this idea of being flooded from outsiders. Germany had absorbed large numbers of refugees from Eastern Europe in the interwar period, hundreds of thousands of particularly Jews, but not just Jews, people from Ukraine, Russia. I mean, the Russian Revolution created an enormous diaspora of refugees all over Europe. I think the nationalism of that era fed on that as well, the sort of migration crisis. This is not Europe's first migrant crisis right now. Something similar followed the Bolshevik Revolution. And there wasn't very concerted efforts to handle it. I mean, the League of Nations existed, but international institutions were pretty weak in terms of managing the flow of refugees. There was not an EU. You know, one of the things that's interesting is there were all these predictions in the late 20th century, and I even just saw an article on Twitter yesterday about how the nation state's, you know, not going to make it through the 21st century. I don't know. I mean, as a construction, it isn't that old. It really only goes back to the 19th century. I don't think it's a coincidence that Italy and Germany, these are countries who unified very, very late in a somewhat chaotic way had very, I think, deep senses of insecurity. Their institutions weren't necessarily super legitimate. In the Italian case, I don't think in many ways many Italians considered themselves truly Italian until the post-war era, 1960s or 70s. Germany, I think that happened a little bit earlier, but, you know, the nation state was born in the 19th century. It had this profound crisis in the early 20th century that culminated in two world wars. And then you have the post-45 era where the nation state was still important, but things like the WTO or the UN, these sort of multinational institutions came to matter more and more and more. We seem to be pivoting back again to this, at least politically, to this moment where, I mean, you look at something like Brexit, nearly every elite person in the country opposed it. And yet this argument that this is our country and it belongs to us was compelling enough to do something that at least a lot of experts say is slightly insane. It's not certainly not going to have beneficial effects for the people it was supposed to. So, yeah, I think extreme nationalism, I think it's way too soon to say that the nation state doesn't matter. And it's a contested category because the indivisible, the so-called resistance right now, they're also laying claim to a vision of America. You look at right now in the news, this debate about DACA, that's in many ways a contest, a tug of war over what it is to be American. Because I think, you know, often we have a tendency, looking at our civics class or saying the Pledge of Allegiance as a little kid, just this idea that the American nation is already formed into just a thing you can sort of grab onto. It's a very nebulous thing, and there's a battle going on right now, whether it's immigration or this issue of monuments. There's a sort of an ideological war almost going on right now to define what America is going to be, and that's absolutely what was going on in Weimar. I think one of the most alarming things you see in Weimar is political polarization that was bred by crisis. That reality of the center collapsing and the left and the right pulling further and further apart was absolutely detrimental to Weimar. So by the last couple elections in 32, as Weimar was in its death throes, the largest party in the country was the National Socialist Party, and the third largest party was the Communist Party. You're in a bad situation when two of the three largest parties in your country are dedicated to destroying the democratic institutions that they actually are running. And that was fed by polarization, the fact that people in the sort of National Socialist, hyper-nationalist milieu on one side and the sort of communist far-left milieu on the other, they lived in totally different realities. They read different media. They could see the same thing. You know, they were watching, say, the Spanish Civil War or events in Ethiopia with totally different lenses. And the disappearance of centrist parties and of centrist politics was certainly detrimental to Weimar's survival. And I know often being a centrist isn't particularly glamorous, you know, especially in a moment where or in which the political center proves incapable of solving problems. I can understand how this polarization could happen, and I feel like we're watching it now.